The race is on, and we've turned this episode of the Race F1 podcast over to you, the listener, to answer the questions you've asked about Formula One, past and present. While we're still waiting impatiently for the Grand Prix season to get going, there's plenty to talk about as always, and we've got a great mix of contemporary topics and thought provokers from the past to delve into. I'm Ed Straw, and my guests with all of the answers are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Scott, how goes things in Sweden? I see you've got your patriotic football shirt on.
Yeah, all good, actually. On the subject of Sweden and patriotism, I'm actually in the process of coming up with a crash helmet design for my my rising interest in esports. Plus, I've always wanted to have sort of my own design just in case I ever do get involved in real world racing again and have my own. And I've decided, because blue and yellow have always been my competition colours, way back, going back to when I was 8 or 9 years old and had my first kart. So blue and yellow has always been really cool for me. Obviously, being out here, it's the colours of Sweden, so it works really well. So I'm going to have, basically what I want to get done is a Ronnie Peterson style crash helmet design. So a metallic blue base with some sort of golden yellow pinstriping and old style sort of block letters on the side. So that is there's a genuine bit of news for the podcast from Sweden there.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to seeing that design. My helmet design when I was racing was white with lots of scuff marks from roll cages and that kind of thing, because I was quite tall. I took up a lot of space in cars. I was very often just sort of glancing it on roll cages and that kind of thing. Fortunately, never did that when crashing. Mark Hughes, did you have a helmet design when you were racing, or were helmets not compulsory back then?
Yeah, I started. My initial one was sort of a red and white stripes, but that one got stolen, or rather the car it was in got stolen, and so I never got around to liverying the next one. It was just plain white.
That's the cheapest way of liverying it.
Yeah, and Rennie Arnoux always had a white one, and I thought he was pretty cool, so there you go.
So it's a sort of red and white helmet colours. Are they the family helmet colour?
It was from Niki Lauda's comeback. When he first came back. So my brother Warren raced like with a Lauda tribute helmet, and it was that really, because if it wasn't about Gilles Villeneuve, it was about Niki Lauda. So the red and white was a Lauda tribute.
So Warren was if you had that style as well, and Lauda had that style. So Warren was the third fastest driver to use that helmet color.
Now you're just getting in the realms of fantasy. Now I don't want to upset my brother.
I like the fact that it's about Niki Lauda or Gilles Villeneuve, because they're rightly or wrongly generally regarded at opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of driving. Although,
like the opposite ends of the spectrum. You're right, but just both fantastic. Just love them both.
Yeah, absolutely. Great drivers. Actually, I've just been working on a piece that actually, by the time you hear this, will be on the race website, which is therace.com. And don't forget the hyphen, about Lauda's last win at Zandvoort in 1985. So if you're a Lauda fan, head to our website to have a look at that. But not before you've listened to us answering your many questions. And I think Villeneuve might come up a bit later in this. But we've got a mix of questions ancient and modern. So we're going to rotate between us fielding some of those questions and having a bit of a chat. But before we get on to those listener questions, Scott, I've got one for you quickly, because there's been one F1 driver in particular in the headlines over the weekend in Lando Norris. He's managed to become embroiled in controversy from the IndyCar iRacing event at Indianapolis held on Saturday. So we've had the 2019 Indy 500 winner, Simon Pagenaud, accused of taking him out, Norris calling the Frenchman salty, whatever that means, McLaren boss Zak Brown getting in on the act as well. With proper row, sim racing really is becoming contentious, isn't it?
Yeah, if anything, it just adds to the realism, doesn't it? A bit of controversy just to show that people really do care about this sort of stuff. So that element of racing is alive and well with the online version. I guess a brief explanation. I'm not an expert in this, but basically, Norris and Pagenaud were involved in an incident when Norris was trying to go inside. I think it might have been Ray Hall, and whether it was Ray Hall moving right to avoid him, or something called net code, which is a phenomenon that occurs in online racing, because with so many people connected to the server, it can be a bit bit of guesswork, basically, from the software or whatever, however you want to call it, that basically positions the car on track actually differently to where it is. So it's possibly that iRacing thought that Norris's car was further to the right and hit Ray Hall's, or Ray Hall's was further to the left and therefore made contact. Either way, Ray Hall ends up going from low to high on the track and takes out Pagano, which Pagano and his spotter seem to think is entirely Norris's fault because he's making an overtake that they believe wouldn't happen in reality. That was a long-winded version. Long story short, Pagano then rejoins, and it's quite clear in the video that the live stream that was being conducted, that he was clearly after some kind of retaliatory action. He told Norris that he didn't mean to take him out. He only wanted to slow him up. But it's quite clear from Pagano's live feed that as he rejoins, he's looking for Lando and he wants to take him out. It isn't just a case of slowing him up. He did explicitly state that he wanted to basically to wreck Lando's race. So that was a massive shame. And basically, Pagano waited for Norris, who was leading, or he was in the lead group, and he'd just taken the lead of the race. So Pagano waited for Norris, who was in the lead, and basically claimed that he was slowing down to come into the pit lane, but he wasn't. He was holding it on the racing line, and then he backed off to the point where Norris obviously didn't expect that action to be taken, and Norris smashed into the back of him, and they both crashed in quite spectacular fashion.
Yeah, and we also saw a chaotic finish with Pato O'Ward hitting leader Marcus Ericsson at the last corner, then Santino Ferrucci wiping out Oliver Askew just before the line, all allowing Australian Supercars ace Scott McLaughlin to win. The fallout from these clashes, as well as the Pagano-Norris incident on social media, has been massive. Some have slated the drivers involved for letting IndyCar down. Others are baffled by these reactions, saying it's only a game. So where do you stand?
I really don't like the suggestion that it's just a game. I think that is such a cop out in terms of standards and just decent driver etiquette, because the bottom line is, this isn't just a game. This matters enough for it to be broadcast live. It matters enough for all of the teams and the drivers to be involved. The sponsors love it. You know, it's taken really seriously. It is a game. It is taking place online. It is not taking place in the real world, but just because it's not in the real world, it doesn't mean that the racing's not real. The big problem for me is that these sort of events thrive on the legitimacy of what you're watching, and we know that professional drivers doing sim racing isn't the same as esports competitors who live and breathe the stuff and are at an even higher level, but it is serious enough for people to be properly invested in it. You know, there's money to be made in betting on it as well, and I just think it shows a lack of class to do what Pagano did, to do what Santino Ferrucci did, a NASCAR style deliberate attempt to wipe out the leading car and steal the victory. He succeeded in wiping out the leading car, but he managed to lose out on the win. So I guess there's some karma there. I just think on this sort of thing, this is the only racing we've got. There's a lot of people who dedicate a lot of time and effort to being good at this stuff, and there's a lot of people that devote time to watching what they want to be a fair, honest and authentic competition. And the actions of the likes of Pagano and Ferrucci rob fans of something proper, and they rob their competitors of a legitimate race.
Well, if nothing else, it shows that events in the esports world can have a big impact on the world of physical racing, something that drivers really are learning the hard way. But let's get on with what we're here for, which is what the listeners have asked us to talk about. So first up, a question from Tessura Mendes, which I'm directing to Scott, which is, what are your thoughts on the comments James Allison made regarding Lewis Hamilton's lack of use of the dark arts? So can you put a little bit of meat on the bone of what that was about and what you think of it?
In a really wide ranging conversation that Mercedes put together with James Allison, James, the Mercedes technical director, talked about all sorts, including Lewis Hamilton's integrity, how he conducts himself on track and off track, and James waxed lyrical about Lewis's aversion to the dark arts of racing. He said you'll really struggle to find evidence of Lewis doing something ugly on track throughout his career, and James said that was unprecedented amongst multiple world champions. I think Mark wrote a great piece that we had originally had this idea of doing a sort of multi-voice piece between us, sort of breaking down different elements of the different world champions and how they went about racing. And then Mark put something together that was basically just so good when I read it the first time. It ended up going up on the race website as a standalone, and it made it clear that Lewis isn't on his own in racing fairly as a world champion. But I certainly think if you take his generation and really the majority of champions over the last 30 or 40 years, certainly Lewis is much less. I would say he's better at judging where the line is and making sure he doesn't go over the line. And I think it's definitely worth, it's a really good question to start with, because we're basically pushing people towards the website and away from the podcast, but it's really worth reading what Mark wrote on this subject, because it really puts those comments into context, and it shines a very honest light on the progression of the dark arts as part of the tool set, if you will, as F1 developed and world championships got a little bit more aggressive with one another.
I think you know, you've got to have a certain toughness in the car. You can't just be nice all the time in the car. But it's, as Scott says, it's a question of where that line is, where you judge that line to be, and how good you are at going up to it, absolutely to the edge of it as needed, whenever you need to, without going over it. And I think that's what Lewis is fantastically good at. And then the piece was putting it in historical context, saying that originally, when the sport was much more dangerous than it is now, really it was nobody raced aggressively, very few anyway, and they soon weeded themselves out. But as the cars, circuits and then the cars became safer, you started to see it creeping in as drivers realized you could use those margins. So it's sort of inevitable, really. You just like when you say that a new tire for a road car has got more grip and therefore it's safer. People just end up using the grip more and going around the corners faster. So it was a similar process to that in that it started to become apparent that there were bigger margins available, and the drivers used them and began to use intimidation as a tool in their kit. And it started creeping in really in the 80s, and it was taken to a new level really by Ayrton Senna, and then it inspired a whole lot of people observing to adopt similar tactics subsequently. But in many ways, Lewis is a sort of a step back from that, and it still races very aggressively, as Nico Rosberg would be able to testify. But I can't recall him ever having gone over that line.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And we should just stress there that we're not talking about drivers never making mistakes, because although they're very rare, particularly now, he has made misjudgments on track, but they've been honest mistakes, shall we say. And it's good, because I think with Hamilton, it is important to him to kind of uphold those standards. He's very aware of the impact he has as a role model on younger drivers. He still has a keen interest in karting. That's genuinely important to him. So I think it's positive that he considers that to be so important, and is sort of showing you don't have to do that. Of course, some will argue that it's easier to do that when you've got a more dominant car or whatever, but I think he's been in enough battles for us to say that that's a kind of legitimate pattern. So I largely agree with James Allison on that one. Next question, we're going back slightly in time. Question for you, Mark. Prime Juan Pablo Montoya versus prime Kimi Raikkonen. Who would you take? So I guess the first thing to do there is define when those drivers were in their prime.
Yeah, Kimi in all his time at McLaren, I would say, was his prime. Juan Pablo had a shorter career. I actually think he was at pretty much the same level all the way through, because it was quite a short career, 2001-06. To answer the question, Kimi, for me, he was more complete. He was quicker. he was devastatingly fast at his peak in the McLaren years. Montoya couldn't live with him when they were paired there, which I'm sure was a contributory reason for Montoya leaving mid-season in 2006. Montoya was fantastic at the wheel-to-wheel racing, and he had this incredible car control as well. He could ambush and overtake out of anywhere, just creative in the way he was able to race people wheel-to-wheel. Definitely one of the sport's greatest overtakers, right up there with Mansell. But his style was less subtle than Raikkonen's, whose feel through the fast corners allowed him to make incredibly few inputs. The distinction to be made between early Kimi, sort of in the Sauber years when he was like flicking the car over curbs and things and looked really spectacular, and Kimi a couple of years in when he was really at his peak. And that was all a much more subtle, nuanced blend of qualities, really. And that's the key to ultimate speed in an F1 car, how being able to just feel where that edge is and just sit it there without any further input. Schumacher was fantastic at it too. Very few have been able to do that as well as peak Kimi. Kimi was just lower wattage as well, less disruptive within a team. I think if you're a top team, that's what you'd go for. Maybe if you're a struggling team with an imbalanced car, you might go with Montoya to bully the car to a lap time and make up places in the race. But as a thoroughbred, purist, fantastically fast driver, peak Kimi every time.
Yeah, Montoya's an interesting case, isn't he? Because we know how good he could be, but a slightly unfulfilled F1 career, you would overall say. But yeah, Raikkonen, that sensitivity, that feel, just even down to the way he was able to, at his peak, just feed in the power and feel the grip and adjust how aggressive he could be on the throttle based on the balance of the car, where the weight was, etc. Really tremendous sensitivity. But I think it's difficult with how good Kimi Raikkonen was at his absolute best to pick him. Although I think you'd probably take Kimi if you're picking them at their peak, but potentially you might pick Montoya if you're looking at more on average over their careers. Although obviously Montoya's was much much shorter.
I think I'd agree with Mark. I'd take a prime Kimi just because I think if you're looking at someone who can sort of piece everything together, I think that was one of the things that I always sort of. I remember watching the pair of them, and while Montoya was the sort of driver who would arguably, maybe as Mark said, in wheel-to-wheel combat especially, maybe Montoya excites you a little bit more. But I just think if you look at it pragmatically, I reckon Kimi would at their peak just edge him over one lap. I reckon they'd be fairly even in race trim, but over a season I can see Kimi taking it. I was going to follow this up by throwing the next question to you, Ed, stealing your role as the presenter and flipping and turning the tables. So there's a bit of a link because it involves a Finn. Danny Herbert asked, do you think George Russell will replace Valtteri Bottas or a retiring Hamilton at Mercedes? And if so, when?
Well, there's multiple parts to this question. The first is whether George Russell's a driver who Mercedes would want in their works team, and I think on the current trajectory, very likely yes. He's in the middle year of a 3-year Williams placement, so that the timeline is very malleable on this. I don't think it helps that this season's being condensed, and probably we're not going to see a full season, as that will slightly limit the development, although I don't think there's any chance of there being much change next year. I think at Mercedes in 2021, we're going to see Hamilton and Bottas again, barring something very unusual happening. Obviously, we're still waiting for those deals to be formalised, as it were. But Russell has unquestionably got the ability to become a driver capable of doing a very good job in a top team. I'd argue he was, by a tiny margin, probably the most impressive of the rookies last year, which is quite a tricky call, because I think you can make a case for any of him, Albon and Norris being the strongest. They were all very impressive. Russell didn't have the chance to really battle properly with everyone, so he had a very different challenge to the others, but did a very good professional job. Quick driver, demolished Robert Kubica, which, while it's a very different Robert Kubica to the original, shall we say, that you can only beat what's in front of you, and that still counts for something. So good sustained performance. We know he's quick. We know he can race well. I think the key for Russell is he needs to show he can thrive in a very tight midfield if Williams can get him there. You want him in situations where he's a Q2 marginal, should we say, or in an ideal world, it'd be great if he was a Q3 marginal. I don't think Williams is going to be at that point. So you really see these situations where that half a tenth or tenth in qualifying makes all the difference, nailing those key passes, those key in-out laps, when the differences between finishing, say, 10th and 12th are razor thin. That was the one thing we couldn't see very often with him last year, just because of the situation he was in. So Russell, definite possibility for Mercedes. I think, all things being equal, it's a good chance he'll end up there, but I don't think it's going to be, it won't be before 2022 at the earliest.
Can I follow that up with a question to Mark? Is that allowed? Can I ask my own question?
You're throwing us into complete anarchy, but I'll allow it to see where you're going with it.
I just wanted to ask Mark what he thinks is the determining factor for the when can you say with any degree of certainty if a driver is ready for that kind of move? Is it based on the quality of the team that they've done a season with? Do you need to see sort of a longer spell with Russell at a team like Williams than, for example, Ferrari saw with Charles Leclerc at a more competitive Sauber outfit, for example?
It's a very delicate balancing point, I think, Scott, because you can promote a guy too soon if he's not quite ready to go up against, you know, if he went up against Lewis, if he was a Valtteri replacement, for example. He might never recover from that. He might never recover from, not being yet at his full potential, and he might never reach his full potential if you do it too early. On the other hand, I think you can go stale in a less competitive car, and you could be ready without it being, you know, particularly obvious. But all of a sudden, if you'd put him in the top car, you would have seen great performances from him. So, I think they've just got to monitor it very carefully. It's extra difficult for George because Valtteri's doing such a great job in that car. In terms of what the team needs, it's a, you know, team that by just gravity tends to center around Lewis, and Valtteri has to find his own space in there. But he's doing that, and he's doing it in a way that everyone's the team still functions beautifully well. And I think George is perfectly capable of doing that as well. I think he's the personality that would be able to do that. And I think he's calm and rational, but still very competitive. I think 3 years in a little team might be a little too long. I think 1 year might have been a bit too early. It really, a lot depends on Valtteri as well.
Well, he could end up with effectively almost 2.5 seasons, couldn't he? So perhaps 2020 might help that timing. Well, let's move on to another question for you, Scott. Matt Burkett asks, as F1 races can only be held on tracks with an FIA Grade 1 licence, which existing track that isn't a Grade 1 do you think would be a good addition to the calendar if it got an upgrade in order to host a Grand Prix?
That is a really difficult question because there's lots of circuits on the list that have Grade 1 that have either hosted Grand Prix or need to be renovated. So it's just because you're a Grade 2 doesn't mean it's a simple simple upgrade. I think, you know, not to get too patriotic, but just from a history point of view, some of the images that I've seen from the from the past, I would love to see a Formula One car on the Grand Prix loop at Brands Hatch. I've been out there for junior single seater series and GT racing and that sort of thing, and it's just one of my favorite places to see an F1 Brands Hatch, going into Hawthorns or anywhere really on the back part of the circuit. And also having a Grand Prix in my home county of Kent would be quite cool. So I'd go Brands.
Any tracks grabbing your fancy, Mark?
I think I'd love to see cars back at Long Beach, but that's a separate thing. I think we're going to be doing something on that soon. Just the images of cars there were over the bumps and over the crests and the risers. You just saw them really in spectacular attitudes, and you saw the drivers having to wrestle with them. That was always one of my favorite tracks. I thought it was a great shame that that Formula One left there.
Yeah, definitely. I'd agree with that one, and that one comes up very, very commonly. I'm just going to throw in one that technically isn't eligible for this answer, but would have been not so long ago, which is Algarve.
But it's your podcast, and you'll do exactly what you want.
I make the rules. But Algarve got its Grade 1 license officially. I think it had it because it had an F1 test license at one stage, because I've actually seen F1 cars run at Algarve. They did a test there pre-season in 2009. Seem to remember it hailing at one occasion, but it's a for a modern example of a circuit, it's really good, popular with the drivers, variety of corners, undulating, and it's one that it's not completely impossible. We could see a Grand Prix at one day. I think that would be quite fun. But there's a good number of circuits around the place.
I just wanted to pick up on something that Mark said. We have got a feature running on the website about old tracks F1 could and should bring back. And I believe, all things being equal, similar to what you said earlier, by the time this podcast comes out, you will be able to find that article online. And it's worth reading, because we've obviously got a sneak peek at what's on the list, and it'll bring back some cool memories for all sorts of different generations of fans.
Yeah, there's some interesting choice on there. I've chosen a circuit that I think I'm going to get a little bit of social media complaints about, but I think it's a much maligned circuit. So check that feature to read about that. Right, next question. We're going back to the past, directed at you, Mark. Can you tell the story of Phoenix, a team that should have raced in 2002 with Prost GP chassis and the old Arrows engines? That's from Mr. Chiank. That's pronounced correctly via Twitter. This, of course, was a continuation of the Prost team that was trying very hard right up to the early stages of the 2001 2002 season to get on the grid. So what can you tell us about it?
Yeah, well, Prost Grand Prix went out of business at the end of 2001, and Tom Walkinshaw's friend Chuck Nicholson, who was a former TWI XJS racer, he was the guy who fronted the Phoenix project, and he won the bid to buy the Prost team's assets, including three chassis. But a bit like a couple of years ago when Force India changed ownership mid-season after falling into administration and became Racing Point, the question was whether the new owner had bought the entry into the 2002 season, in this case, as well as the assets, because that recognised team entity was worth $12 million of team payments in 2002. Now, both Walkinshaw with Arrows and Paul Stoddard with Minardi were struggling along on the bare bones of staying in existence, and indeed Arrows went out of business later in that season. Stoddard had also bid for the Prost assets, but just with the idea of using the cars and other bits and pieces, and he was pleased with the absence of the actual Prost team in 02 because it meant Minardi would have a better chance of getting some team money from F1 by finishing one place higher in the championship. But he lost out in the bid to Nicholson. But even worse than that for him was that the Nicholson-Walkinshaw plan of keeping that team going as well as Arrows. So Stoddard was very active in trying to get it stopped. Walkinshaw was clearly reckoning on not spending too much money on keeping this sort of ghost team going, just turning up with the cars and cashing the team payments. So they'd paid $2 million for the assets, but would potentially get $15 million of team payments. And obviously the plan was to keep the running cost to nearly nothing. The car was being prepared from a corner of the Arrows workshop. There was no engine supply with the deal, so they borrowed an old Hart engine from the Arrows three-seater, had that grafted onto the back of the Prost chassis, which had been designed for a Peugeot engine. They couldn't get it ready in time for Melbourne, and they presented two nose cones to the scrutineers, just to register that Phoenix existed. And obviously the nose cones failed scrutineering. But they apparently had two cars at Malaysia for the next race, but the FIA refused to allow them an entry. And that's when the court case started. Nicholson, fronting for Walkinshaw, was claiming that the FIA was restricting him when it had no right to. The court found that the FIA was perfectly entitled to do this because Nicholson had effectively just bought some old bits not the Prost team's entry into the 2002 championship. So this came as just a further blow to Wongshaw's efforts at trying to keep Arrows afloat. It wasn't a real team. It was just a last desperate act to stay in business.
That's one of my favourite answers I think that we've ever done on one of these podcasts. And the phrase, the nose cones failed scrutineering, is going to stick with me now for a long time. Ed, you're going to have to go some way to make me laugh the way parts of that story made me laugh, because the next question is for you. And it's a bit more modern. Maybe there will still be some politics at play here. You can decide. Callum Daly says, there have been some rumours recently regarding a possible move for Sainz to replace Vettel at Ferrari. What are your thoughts on this? And as a follow-up, should he leave McLaren, who do you think could replace him?
Well, that's it's a not very funny question, so I'm not going to make you laugh in this one, unfortunately, unless I come up with a risible response. I think Ferrari, all things being equal, would like to keep Vettel for next year. Yes, he's out of contract, but with continuity of cars, etc., it makes sense for him to continue. I suspect that probably will happen, Vettel continuing, although it's still not done. So there's lots of scope for something going wrong there. If you're Ferrari, you'll have a list of people you'd be interested in, and 100% Carlos Sainz Jr. should be on that list. So Sainz, Ricciardo, Lando Norris is probably another driver you'd look at. Sainz, I believe, his original McLaren contract was 2 years, but there may well be an option for a third year in that one as well. So how available he is, I'm not entirely sure about, but definitely you would look very, very, very seriously at Sainz. He's an extremely good driver. We talked about this actually on our McLaren podcast last week. He's brilliant executor of races, quick driver, good qualifier. He ticks all the boxes and took another step forward last year, and I think he'd do a really good job at Ferrari. If Sainz was to leave, then I think McLaren's replacement should be Daniel Ricciardo, because were Sainz to end up at Ferrari, that means Ricciardo's not ending up there. Ricciardo's out of contract. McLaren's been interested in him in the past. If Renault isn't showing the upward mobility that McLaren's showing, it would make sense for Ricciardo to go there. Cracking driver, very motivated, you know, perfect choice. And I think, you know, this comes down to the fact that Ricciardo and Sainz are two of the drivers that would be right at the top of any team's list if they had a vacancy.
Could Vettel end up at McLaren, do you think, Mark? I mean, I don't really see it, but I see every now and again he seems to get linked there. If he gets shunned from Ferrari but wants to stay in F1, maybe he'll try and get in at McLaren or Red Bull.
Yeah, I mean, as Ed says, I think Seb is still Ferrari's number one choice for that seat, but whether he'd be prepared to go there on the terms Ferrari will offer, I don't know. So at that point, if it gets to that point, it would be then Seb's decision. Well, do I still want to do this so much that I'll continue somewhere else, or does he take that as his cue for retirement? And if he decided he was going to continue, well, yeah, McLaren would be probably the best available options in that scenario. I could see it happening. I don't think it's the number one most likely scenario. For me, I think he will continue with Ferrari, but I don't think it's impossible.
Well, Scott, you're up now. Will Dodds asks, with revenues likely to fall if behind closed doors races become commonplace, how big a threat is the virus to F1's existence? A very big question there for you.
Yeah, I'll answer it seriously, which will be a first for me. I think F1 itself is okay. There's no absolute guarantee, obviously, but I think it is in a position financially with Liberty Media to ride out the crisis. I think it's got the capital to do that. There's been a complex series of transactions within the Liberty Media company structure that's freed up more than $1 billion in liquidity for F1 to deploy as it sees fit. I think it's going to, I think various measures, it's put its best foot forward in terms of saving the 10 teams that are on the grid at the moment. So I think, considering the circumstances, this is the best chance it's got of riding out the crisis without losing any teams. It's obviously impossible to say with certainty whether or not all the manufacturer teams will stay in their current form, because you never know whether or not a company or a boardroom level is going to turn around and say that they need to cut F1 to protect the business, because ultimately Formula One's not the bread and butter for a lot of these companies, with the exception of Ferrari. I would say that all of the teams that have serious investors to satisfy are vulnerable to an extent. So I think F1 as a championship survives this. It certainly doesn't survive it in the form that we know it, because there is going to be the technical rules have been delayed. There's going to be a reduction in the budget cap, but we just don't quite know how much that will be. And there could be a changing of the pecking order. I think there's also a second part to this question, is about motorsport as a whole, which I think does stand to be seriously under threat because of the virus. I think there's going to be lots of series that unfortunately will probably become casualties, if not this season, then over the next two or three years as circumstances play out. And I think there will be teams as well that struggle to the end of it. There's been some serious players at the FIA have likened this to the fallout of things like the Great Depression and the Second World War, in terms of needing a total reset and build up from the grassroots again. You know, that's an attitude that's shared at the very top of the F1 by the likes of Jean Todt and Graham Stoker. So it's a very, very, very serious time for motorsport to navigate as a whole. F1 being at the pinnacle, being the richest of those championships, it's got the absolute best chance of getting through it without being... it's going to be fundamentally affected, but without being put to ruin, shall we say.
Yeah, and plenty of work being done to try and stabilise things. So it's really just a question of how much F1 has changed. But I imagine a few years down the line, it'll be carrying on very similar to always, for better or worse. Some of that will be for good reasons. Some of that will be not so good. Well, let's move back into the past now with a question for you, Mark. This is a two-part question. The first bit is, why is Gilles Villeneuve's win in Jarama 81 considered to be one of the greatest drives of all time, yet Thierry Boutsen's win at Hungary in 1990 derided as one of the worst? Now, that comes from a certain Andrew van der Berg, who is, of course, all of our bosses here at the race. There's a supplementary question from Leo Gorman, another motorsports writer, who says, if the Jarama race happened today, would it be appreciated or derided? So that the short version of those races, Spain 81, Villeneuve, they're not especially good Ferrari, kept a train of cars behind him, won the race. Thierry Boutsen in 1990 at Hungary took his third and final win for Williams with a no-stop strategy, holding off Senna to the checkered flag. So, yeah, Mark, how do you want to tackle the various elements of that question?
I think it was Boutsen's haircut. I think that was the difference. Yeah, he had that sort of stupid bowl cut, didn't he?
If anything, Thierry Boutsen's splendid hair surely augments his legend.
I think Gilles Villeneuve had proven already to be one of the fastest and most exciting drivers of all time. And in 80-81, that's a period, there was a real frustration among fans that he was driving this dog of a Ferrari. He just won Monaco on a car that shouldn't have been even in the front half of the field, so making it seem like he could do miracles. So when circumstances made it possible for him to do it again the very next race, it was fantastically thrilling. And to watch him on the verge of possibility of pulling this off, but against that train of faster cars, was real edge-of-the-seat stuff that the fans were really invested in. They wanted to see him pull off the impossible again. In terms of the quality of the drive and the demands, yes, Boutsen's drive was quite similar, but Boutsen was simply a good, solid driver capable of winning if everything was in place. He drove a perfect pressure race there in Hungary. Though as Williams FW13 was a much better car relative to the opposition than the 81 Ferrari. But even disregarding that, it wasn't as exciting a prospect watching an okay driver fend off the greatest of his time, Senna, as watching the greatest of his time, Villeneuve, fending off the rest. You don't want to root for the lesser driver to be the greater one. You want it to be a meritocracy. But you do want to root for the greater driver finding a way to defeat the lesser drivers in better cars. So taken in isolation, those two races were much the same. But you'd need no knowledge of who any of those drivers were not to have that context. I think that's the reason why they're perceived in very different ways. As to whether Villeneuve's drive would be derided now or celebrated, no, I think it would still be celebrated. If it, given that it was the same personalities involved, I think he would capture the imagination in just the way he did at the time. I think it would be still a fantastically thrilling contest in modern context.
It is interesting sometimes how the perception of who what the drivers involved are does impact the perception. I'd agree with your estimation of those. I mean, Bootson's win on that day was a really fine one, I'd argue. You know, he's struggling with brake problems. His left rear tyre was going, and in fact, Senna on his way to trying to catch him turfed Nannini off at the chicane as well with a slightly aggressive pass. So I think that Bootson win deserves to go down as a great win as well. But sometimes I think that probably the crux of this is that great wins by not great drivers sometimes get ignored a bit. Because sometimes there are days when the stars align for a kind of decent performers and they do something wonderful, but the great drivers obviously do it consistently, and Villeneuve was able to do this. I do think there'd be, if that happened today, a little bit of... I think there'd be a certain amount of miserableness on from certain corners of social media about drives, because you could compare Ricciardo's drive at Monaco when he won to Bootson's, and a lot of people were miserable about that, acting as if it was really, really, really easy, which frankly it wasn't. I think there's a little bit of a tendency for people to just run down performances needlessly.
And Hamilton's in Monaco last year under pressure from Verstappen. I think the factor for both of those races, I don't know about the two of you, but it seems quite easy for people to criticise those wins because it's Monaco, and in modern times Monaco is just assumed to be a procession, and on a Sunday it's no challenge as long as you keep it out the wall, because it's impossible to overtake. I would like to think that in 10 or 20 years' time, Ricciardo's drive after he lost the MGUK, didn't he? The Renault MGUK failure. I'd like to think that win, particularly after it came, was it a year after he was robbed or 2 years after he was robbed of an authentic victory in Monaco, and Hamilton's defence against Verstappen last year. I'd like to think that in 10 or 20 years' time, people will look back on that fondly, but whether or not the two of you think that people will have such rose-tinted glasses on the internet in 10 or 20 years' time, I don't know.
Yeah, I dread to think how the internet commentary will have gone in 2 decades.
Well, I'll throw the next question to you, Ed, to bring it back to the present, as we've sort of gone from the past to the future there. Kieran Dudson asks, do you think that F1 may need to push hard for some new teams to join for the regulation change to bolster the grid in case some of the current teams fall off? So a bit of a follow-up to the existential crisis that F1 faces that we were talking about a little while ago.
I'll have to answer no to that, which is a slightly for slightly complicated reasons, because gearing up to run a Formula One team, even for the new regulations, requires monstrous investment, enormous lead time, etc., etc. And I think if there was to be something like that happening, it would probably be a little bit, it'd be very half-baked, potentially, unless there's someone out there who's really got massive resources. There are a few credible projects going on, but I think pushing for any new ones is going to be very, very optimistic. Formula One, sadly, is just not geared up for new teams to come in. The real focus should be ensuring that the 10 existing teams can continue to exist, can continue to race, and if any of the major backers of the teams, for example, Renault, because people have speculated Renault's involvement could go, we need to make sure that those teams work in a way that they can be picked up by a new owner in the future, much like Racing Point was when Force India ran out of steam financially, just to make sure that those 10 entities continue to work. I think Formula One would benefit from being more accessible for new teams, but I don't see... There are things in the 2021 regulations that make it a little bit more... That do make... The 2022 regulations, I should say now, they've been put back, that make it a little bit more accessible and possible, but it's still hugely complicated. It's not like the old days where, you know, a good F2 team could ramp up a little bit, get a few people in and build a Grand Prix car. It's just not that simple. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, Formula One is not at that scale. The scale is too big for that. And that's one of the things it needs to address probably as we look to the years ahead. The size of the teams is probably too big for the circumstances in which they exist now. And so as I think we'll inevitably see it become a smaller sport. And in those circumstances, you may be able to conceive of new teams possibly being attracted to it, specialist teams probably, rather than automotive. But I think to be thinking of new teams being able to replace existing teams is a non-starter, really. If the existing teams are in trouble, it's for a reason. It's not that they're badly run teams. It's because of the circumstances, the environment in which it exists. And it wouldn't be any better for any new team. In fact, it'd probably be a lot worse.
Well, moving on, Scott, esports is a big thing at the moment, obviously, with no real racing really going on. This question from Tom Corley is, in this age of virtual Grand Prix, could you have an F1 journalists race? He suggests he'd like to see Mark Hughes put his money where his mouth is. I'm not sure what you've been mouthing off about, Mark, but perhaps someone could hook Nigel Roebuck up with a simulator. And then the second question from Kevin Joyce saying, could we see Mark investing in a simulator? Because rumour has it Assetto Corsa has mods available for Rally Choppers. Now, before, Mark, you delve in and commit yourself to something on esports, we're going to have our resident esporter, yeah, Scott Mitchell, who did turn up in the Race All-Star Esport Battle brought to you by Rocket recently. And you performed actually surprisingly well, I would say, but you're getting quite into your esports stuff as well. So F1 journalist race, would you win it?
I'm not going to say I would win it. I would like to think I'd have half a chance of being competitive. I'd enjoy it. I think there is one of the good things is a lot of the journalists in Formula One, there is a passion for racing involved, and I do get annoyed at the suggestion that sport. I've heard when I was at university, we were told that there was a general ill feeling from so-called proper journalists to sports journalists because sports journalists were just fans with typewriters. And my response to my lecturer when he said that was jokes on him because I don't use a typewriter. But there is a genuine passion for motor racing amongst a lot of the Formula One journalists. As a result, as we've sort of touched on throughout earlier in this podcast, quite a few of us have racing backgrounds of certain sort of qualities, shall we say, or success. So I think it would be great fun. I'm really curious to know what Mark putting his money where his mouth is means. Have you been sort of suggesting on Twitter that you'd be absolutely smashing everybody if you just only had a simulator you could use?
No. I think this has arisen from conversations I've had with Tom Corley himself. Tom Corley is possibly one of the he tells me that he's one of the world's greatest jazz pianists, and I believe him, but how do you know? that's what he's talking about. I've not really got into it, to be honest. I tell you what, listening to Dario Franchitti talk about it, there was a podcast that the race did a couple of weeks ago. Claire Cottingham was asking about it. And that was fascinating because he was saying how difficult it was for him to transition between, you know, being a real racing driver and being an e-racer. And he said the most difficult thing about it is you can't judge the car in sim by feel because obviously there isn't any. It all has to be learned. And I'd say that it's a very interesting discussion because it's a different core skill, but there's some overlapping skills. So the similarities are just in the routine functions, you know, the knowledge of the track, the understanding of where buttons are, the understanding of what race and etiquette is, those things. So there's competitiveness. So that's obviously that you have that in common. There's learned skills, and both real and sim have that. But then there's the core inner sort of physiology that determines who's quick in a real car and who isn't. And if that's not there, you can be the most competitive person on the planet and do the most intense preparation of anyone ever, and you still won't be quick in a real car. You'll be okay, but you'll not be at F1 level. And in that core skill, there isn't crossover. And it was fascinating listening to Dario talk about this. You can't judge the car and sim by feel because there isn't any, so it all has to be learned, which equally, obviously, is just about learning, which a competitive person like a top racing driver will obviously be very motivated to do if he's going to do it. If he's got some spare time and he wants to do it, he's not just going to do it for the sake of it. So he's going to compete. So I think it's been very interesting watching it. They're not probably as quite as adept as the absolute top e-racers, but you know, I don't think it would take very much to make them so. But I think if you, I honestly don't think you would have the same, I might get shouted down for this, but I don't think you would have anything like the same success ratio putting the e-racers into real cars.
No, I agree with you completely, because one of the things that I find fascinating is when it comes to the adaptation either way, I think it's actually, while I agree with you that you certainly wouldn't have the same success rate if you went from racing online, however good these simulators are, to racing a real car, I think it's harder in a lot of cases for real drivers to adapt to the sim world, because when you go from sim to reality, yes, a lot of the stuff is it is literally real. So there are sort of consequences that come with that that make it harder, but you're only adding inputs. You're adding things that you can use to be quick, that sort of seat of the pants feel, and just the sort of greater connection between you, the car, and the road. Whereas I think when real world drivers first switch to sim racing, you're taking away inputs, and I think that's really hard for real world drivers to adapt to, because suddenly this thing that you've been basing your driving on for 5, 10, 15, 30 years, some of these legends are legends for a reason. So I certainly agree that when it comes to the absolute peaks, you definitely wouldn't have the success that you see some of the top sim racers have. It's not completely transferable, but I think they would maybe get up to their level quicker than it would sometimes takes a legend to get up to speed on a sim race, because it is like completely relearning a discipline.
It's a great thing to do. I must admit, I don't really have a setup for doing it, but I am now starting to get involved with doing some engineering work for you, Scott. So we had the first race where I think you learned that you need to listen to your engineers more, and we're going to be building up complicated run plans and that kind of thing. So quite looking forward to that with your esports antics.
I think actually what I learned from that foray was you shouldn't fit wet tyres by accident in a dry race. That was horrific.
I'd like to emphasise that was entirely your fault. Nothing.
Yeah, funny how the engineer doesn't take responsibility for the accidental strategy change mid race.
Yeah, I didn't think to warn you not to put on wets in the dry. Evidently, you thought you were Kimi Raikkonen at Malaysia a few years ago.
I honestly didn't realise that was possible. I accidentally pressed the wrong button. Now that is something that, I say that is something that doesn't happen in real life. Last year in Germany, Toro Rosso put Pierre Gasly out on wets, didn't they, on a steel dry track, because they were trying to second guess the elements.
Yeah, it does happen, and there are cases of people pressing the wrong button. Nigel Mansell, I think, had a bit of a mishap in Canada one year, pressing a button accidentally at an inopportune moment. Well, another question. I really like this question. This one's directed at you, Mark, which is, which of today's crop of F1 drivers would be most suited to racing an F1 in the 50s, 60s with no downforce? Now, that comes from someone I know. I've only got the name Chris for, but because that question came via you, I think first you can supply his surname before answering that question.
That is from Sam.
Have I written down the wrong name completely?
Yeah. Sam Burgess.
I'll just put the wrong name down.
Yeah,
well done.
Sam Burgess, yeah, that is.
I like to call him Chris.
Yeah, he's known as Chris. He's known as Chris, the people who don't know him. But to his friends, he's called Sam. I don't think it would be that different, actually. I think the same top guys would still be on top. It would just look different watching it. I think Hamilton, Verstappen would still be right up the absolute top without downforce. Probably Leclerc too. Others who would be fantastic would be Ricciardo, Sainz. I mean, Sainz in the wet, it's quite a similar in terms of grip to power, which is what you're varying. The wet sort of goes some way to simulating how it would be without downforce, so the reduction in grip. watching Carlos Sainz in the wet is fantastic. He's maybe it's because he's out in the rally car so often. Him and his dad go off to have their own rally stage, and they're always in it. So he has this wonderful car control, and he always seems to be able to bring the car back from anywhere. And although that's not his natural style in the dry. But he was, there were a few wet sessions when he was at Renault where he was quicker than Hülkenberg, who was always the barometer of, the wet weather driver. I think Alex Albon would be great to watch. I think he's another one who can very confident in having the car move around him. But yeah, by and by, I think the same guys would still be the top guys.
I think one other interesting name you could throw in if we were to create a hypothetical situation where you're suddenly transplanting the drivers right now as they are into these cars, because I do agree that the cream would rise. An interesting case is Lance Stroll. Very good in the wets. He's had some very strong performances at low downforce tracks, Baku, Monza, even in dry conditions. So I think he could be one whose ability would show through a little bit more, because he seems to struggle a bit more with the precision in the higher downforce conditions.
Yeah, it's true. When he's gone well, I've been at either tracks with low grip or low grip surface or low downforce. He's been quick at Baku. He's been quick at Monza. So yeah, I think there's probably something in that.
I was going to suggest that maybe it would be a case of the drivers who react on feel rather than having to work their way towards the limit would benefit more. And actually, I was going to elaborate on that more, but it leads quite nicely into another question we've got. So I'll just throw that question straight to you, Ed. It's from, you've only written V. Mackinnon, so I can only assume it's V. Tommy Mackinnon that has sent this question in. They said, if teams' access to data was limited, would that bring more randomness to Formula One, or would the better idea be just to scrap one free practice session?
Well, the less data there is to go through, the less well-honed the cars will be, the less time the drivers to fully acclimatise. I wouldn't necessarily say randomness is the word, because I'm not sure randomness is quite the thing we're looking for. Although, given the name Mackinnon, I suspect that this is not not necessarily English as a first language. So, being too pedantic about the exact words, I'd say maybe unpredictability is the word that's being looked for there. And I think if you've got less time to prepare, less time to fettle your car, to understand, to analyse, to try, etc., then you'll be operating by nature in a slightly wider band. So there'll be more time, more opportunity for one team to be a little bit off, a few tenths off its ultimate potential. Another team delivers the maximum of its potential. So you get a little bit more moving around. I actually quite like the idea of being able to cut back on some of the amount, that the sheer volume of number crunching and analysis that's done. But we should also remember that a hell of a lot of it is done before you even get to the track. So you'd have to, as well as perhaps limiting access at the track, you'd have to try and limit some of the preparatory work away from the circuit. I think there is, though, there's an appeal to having... I'm really impressed with what the top Grand Prix teams do, the amount of work, the analysis they do, the race rooms back at base, the simulation stuff, the driver-in-loop simulation, the stuff. It's absolutely astonishing. And data is not just this magic answer that you print out and it's on a sheet of paper and it tells you everything. It's just a massive information from which you can start to extract the answer. So it's a massively impressive thing. So let's not fool ourselves into thinking it automatically does the work for you, because it doesn't. But I think it is appealing to have a little bit more of an organic and human relationship between the driver, the way they drive, how they're getting the best out of the car, the setup work, etc. And that would, by its very nature, create more unpredictability, because you'll see people bouncing around within the kind of range of what their car's capable of. So I think it would be interesting. And if we have condensed race weekends, that's one thing that might make a difference, because if you've got, let's say, if you have a weekend where you've got free practice in the morning and then you're into qualifying a few hours later and that's all you've got, then you're only going to have a few hours to analyse data. You will not be able to do the same amount of work. So it would interest me to see it. So what do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I think it would randomise it a little bit, but I think the teams with the most powerful analysis tools would still be the top teams. But you would get more dropped. You know, somebody's dropped out of the window. You see it occasionally. You see it maybe with a top team. You see it maybe three or four times a year. You'd probably be seeing it a lot more than that. But there would still be a more consistent performance from the top teams and from the teams below them.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, one of the rules is that the big teams and the best teams are still the biggest and the best teams, aren't they? If you give them less time, there's still more they can get through. Although it would be interesting, because if you're having to suddenly scale down from a huge amount of time to go through it to a smaller amount, you might actually find it a little bit harder than somebody who's used to operating on a little bit less, shall we say. But you see that with that analytical capacity. Haas is a great example of that, in that they had a big problem last year, and if they'd been a big team, they'd have got onto the fundamental root cause of that problem a hell of a lot quicker than they actually did. You know, data and knowledge is power ultimately. We've got an enormous list of questions, and I think we're gonna spread this out over a few podcasts. I think, because one thing we do want to do on this podcast is bring back Scott's People, which has stuttered recently. We've tried to bring it back a few times. Scott Mitchell assures me that he wants to make sure Scott's People, as it were, not Scott's Mitchell. He already is his own Mitchell. Whether that's going to be a regular thing. So, explain yourself and what the hell is going on.
Yeah, unfortunately, in these unprecedented and extraordinary times, unfortunately, we've all had to make sacrifices. I've been trying to do right by my people and manage things in an appropriate way. So I definitely didn't just forget about it every time we had to do a podcast. This was a deliberately managed situation, just to ration the use of Scott's People.
So rationed but not furloughed.
Yes, exactly. No, I hasten to add, I'm not in a position to unfortunately pay 80% or £2,500 a month to listeners of this podcast. I'd love to, but I simply can't. But we are back. This time I asked, we're in lockdown at the moment, obviously, in a lot of places. So if you could watch one race from any series with a driver of your choice, what is it, with which driver, and why? And I got a lovely response. Obviously, people have forgiven me for my heinous crime of just ignoring them for weeks. Quite a few F1 entries and then a few non-F1. So I'll rattle through some F1 ones quickly. Renton picked the 2006 Chinese Grand Prix. He would like to watch that with Michael Schumacher, or in his words, a certain German driver in a Bridgestone-shod car, which had been written off as having no chance of winning the race. So that was the first one. Phil Branigan, off of Australian motorsport journalism fame, picked the 2001 Bathurst 1000 with John Cleland. And Branners gets additional points here for describing it as a ripper race, which I presume as an Australian he is obliged to do at least once during any given sentence. And he says he wouldn't have to say anything for nearly 7 hours. Having met Branners, John Cleland would be the winner from that scenario. Another non-F1 from Alex Davey picked the 1998 BTCC round at Donington with Nigel Mansell. And he would ask Nigel while watching where he got the performance from in that car. That is definitely one of my favourite touring car races of all time. Alejo, I think that's how you pronounce it, picked the 24 Hours of Le Mans from 2015. He'd like to watch it with the Porsche winning trio of Nico Hülkenberg, Nick Tandy, and Ed's favourite early Bamba, winning the race for the first time with the 919, battling the Audis, Toyotas, and also commenting on the largely disappointing Nissan GTR LM. Colm Lawless picked the 08 Italian Grand Prix with Sebastian Vettel, which, good choice. Alex Hunt going back much earlier than that, 40 years in fact. Sir Jackie Stewart and the 1968 race at the Nürburgring for a masterclass in wet weather driving. Loads more. Chris Hoffman picked Alexander Rossi and the 2016 Indy 500. There's obviously a theme here. Mansell is obviously an exception, but there's a theme here of watching like career highlights with drivers. Obviously, Damon Hill's highlight wasn't winning the 1998 Belgian Grand Prix, but it was a highlight within his career. And Alan Fouracre said that he'd like to watch that with Damon winning for Jordan. A couple of others, because there were loads. I might even save some of these for next time. Natalie, who is an Envision Virgin Formula E fan, picks the 2009 Paris E-Prix with Robin Freins. Formula E's first wet race with so much drama. I'm a massive Robin Freins fan, so I heartily endorse this. And Jamie Penning, I hope I pronounced your surname correctly there, he would like to relive he would like to relive the Monaco Grand Prix in which Jules Bianchi finished in the points, and he would obviously like to watch that back through with Jules. So a poignant one to end on, but I thought that was quite nice because obviously everybody would dearly love to still have Jules around. And I will end, I want more of these, so I'm going to ask this question again just because there's so many combinations here. I haven't even been able to get through them, and it's just nice because every now and again you see a race that you've not thought of for a while. But I would like to end just really quickly by asking the two of you, we're in lockdown or shutdowns or whatever restrictions you want to call what you're living through at the moment, if you could pick one race to watch back with one driver, I'm putting you both on the spot, what would it be and why?
For me, I'd go for obviously one that everyone remembers well, which is the 1935 rather German Grand Prix. Tazio Nuvolari's famous victory for Alfa Romeo, one of the great Grand Prix victories, the impossible win, I think it was known as. But it'd just be fascinating to, because I've always liked the idea, if I had a time machine, of going back to that era and just seeing these great drivers, Nuvolari, Rosemeyer, Caracciola, and actually really being able to appreciate how the driving style, the approach, the characteristics of the car, just everything they're doing, because it's something you can only really experience through reading about it. There's very little footage. You can watch little glimpses of it, but even compared to when you're getting into post-war racing, there's a little bit more to go on. But that period is so difficult to really get a firm sort of first-hand handle on. It'd just be fascinating to see, great victory, understand how Nuvolari did it, how he drove, and what made him unquestionably a great driver. And I just think it'd just be fantastic to see that artistry at work.
Mark, can I put you on the spot as well? Do you have one that jumps to mind?
Yeah, I'd like to sit with Mario Andretti in a few beers and watch the 81 Indy 500, which he won, really, but was disqualified from or penalised from and lost out to Bobby Unser. And so we'd just like to re-examine that. And it might be a bit painful for Mario, but I'd just like to get the ins and outs of, because it was to do with how he rejoined the circuit after his pit stop. So I'd just like to get the real lowdown with Mario about that.
Yeah, I have actually spoken to Mario Andretti about that. An interesting side point for that is at the time, this was at Indianapolis a few years ago, he was wearing the 81 Indy winner's ring, which he'd firmly hung on to. So he's in no doubt about who won that race. It was him rather than Unser. So yeah, it'd be fascinating.
I'm going to answer my own question as well, just to complete the set. It might well, and it might sound a bit unimaginative. I would really like to watch back Brazil 08 with Lewis. I'd really love to, because there's a lot in that race that you can see where sort of it looks like it's in control, then it sort of slips away a little bit, then it looks firmly in control, and then obviously it goes utterly insane towards the end. And there's just so much going on, especially in the last sort of 15-20 minutes of the race, that I think it would just be I think that would be a fascinating experience. So I'll be a bit boring, go for something a bit more modern and a little bit more sort of probably predictable, but I'm nothing if not boring and predictable.
Well, you oblige me to throw in my little story about that race, in that I'd organised to do a kind of a little bit of an atmosphere championship clincher piece with McLaren. And they said, yeah, if it's all looking good, 10, 15 laps from home, yeah, you can go into the garage, hang around in the garage, see how everyone reacts and everything. So, of course, it was fine for me to go in because he was in a good position. And then the rain came and the pit stop happened and all this drama happened. It was meant to be kind of just like a calm cruise to the title, but it was fantastic. All the ups and downs of the whole thing. And then that just a kind of eruption when it happened. I can still remember there was a monitor that was on a sort of pole, for want of a better word, in the garage. It was sent spinning as various mechanics ran. So yeah, that one I always remember very, 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 very keenly. Well, Scott's people, get on board with that. So tell Scott what you'd like him to talk about on that one in the future, what race you'd like to follow with a driver, and we promise to make sure Scott is a bit more diligent with looking after his people in future. Like I said, we have got loads of questions. We've got through about a dozen today. We've probably got enough for another two podcasts, so we'll probably keep working through it. If your question wasn't answered on this one, very likely it's on the list. If your question was answered, thanks very much for contributing. If you do have a question, feel free to throw it at us on social media. If you throw it at me, at EdStrawF1, or throw it at Scott, who's at SMitchellF1, and Mark Hughes, who's at SportMPH, or at We Are The Race, we will add
Sport
that to
MPH
the list.
SportMPH
Mark, Ed. Oh, is it SportMPH Mark?
Yeah, you know better than me. Yeah, it is. You're quite right, Scott, SportMPH Mark.
God damn it, Ed.
next time we have to talk Twitter handles, I'm just going to throw it over to you to do it, because you're clearly much more effective at it. But yeah, do keep throwing questions at it. We might be able to just to keep up answering people's questions until Formula One gets going with the amount we come through. So yeah, we'll probably be back next week. Well, we'll definitely be back next week, but probably with more questions, unless there's a more pressing contemporary topic that requires our attention. So stay home, stay safe, and join us next time on the Race F1 Podcast.